Hello and welcome to episode 151 of the 1099 for the week of June 4th, 2018. I'm your host, Josiah Renauden, and with me today is the former video producer at Eurogamer and Video Gamer, the host and creator of Here's a Thing, and now his own boss at People Make Games. Chris Bratt, Chris, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm still not ready to hear an introduction like that, I don't think. That's weirded me out.
Is it the former Eurogamer part that's weird, or his own boss at People Make Games?
Oh, a real mix of the two right now, of hell. Yeah,
that's the cocktail I'm handing over to you right now. Like, please try to actually... I mean, this will go live about 2 or 3 weeks from now, but as we're recording this, you are... just a few days removed from, I mean, starting your own venture, starting your own thing and flipping that crowdfunding switch. And I mean, congratulations, first off, that's doing exceptionally well.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's been 4 days. Yeah, honestly, I don't know. I know you've interviewed a number of people that use Patreon or supported by Patreon on your podcast, but I don't know how close to the actual launch you've interviewed someone before. Right now I am just
this
not...
is the closest,
right? Yeah, it's a really bizarre feeling. I'm just sort of getting used to the whole idea. It's something I've been planning for just months now, in a number of different forms as well, and now for it to have actually happened and for it to have worked enough that I can do it is an amazing feeling, but also just a really overwhelming one at the moment.
Who did you talk to in the lead up to this? Because of course, there's a lot of people out there who have found success on this. Some of those people might be your friends or your colleagues, but everyone has a different concept they're trying to quote unquote sell to people. Everyone has different audiences. And if you look at something like Kickstarter, it seemed like at the start, everyone was getting money, but as more of those happened and more of that money started to kind of dry up, it was harder to launch something. So who did you talk to get some sort of idea of how is this going to land with people?
Yeah, a bunch of different people, actually. I figured that the more sort of insight into how the whole thing works, the better. You've had some of these people on your podcast before, but Daniel Dwyer, Mark Brown, who both have incredibly successful patrons, but in different areas of the games media. Matt Lees, who I used to work with, Video Gamer, now does Cool Ghosts and Shop and Sit Down, both crowdfunded enterprises. And yeah, the Patreon themselves, I actually visited them whilst I was at GDC. They're in San Francisco, their main headquarters. And
oh man, you met John Patreon.
Yeah, that's quite an odd... So I'm from the Midlands in England, which is... I find, having moved down to Brighton on the South Coast, I find that a big enough jump in my mind to get used to. But San Francisco is on a whole other level. Like, I walked into the Patreon office and I was a few minutes early and I sat down on the sofa just in the lobby waiting for a meeting that was scheduled. And two, like, Patreon employees came and had an impromptu meeting whilst sitting cross-legged just in the lobby next to me, not really paying attention to the fact that I was there. And there were chairs around. Like, it wasn't that I'd stolen the last seat. There were chairs. But yeah, it's that company is unusual. But yeah, it seems to work very well.
Yeah, something's working well for them. Maybe the secret to all business is you need to sit cross-legged when the chair's available. Maybe there's some weird, like, deep meaning there that we all don't understand. It's like, hey, take the path less traveled, sit on the floor with your legs crossed or something like that. You mentioned there was a whole bunch of variations before. What did those look like? How many different times had you kind of tweaked and changed around what the formula for your videos would be and kind of what that pitch would be?
So originally... So I worked on a series at Eurogamer called Here's a Thing, which this is very much an extension of, a sort of bigger and hopefully better version of, is the plan. And that was something I did at Eurogamer as a side project to the rest of my work. I worked on the video team and we had a bunch of different stuff on that goes up on the channel, sort of the daily content kind of idea that you see a lot of game publications following. And so I was involved with all of that, but then the real passion project on the side was Here's a Thing, and I just wanted to see if it could work. And it's been by far the most popular thing I've ever been involved with professionally, so that was awesome. But it just planted this seed that, oh my god, I would love to actually try and do that full time, not do it in the evenings and at weekends and borrow bits of time here and there and finish the video. It was like literally as I upload them, like it was yeah, it's that. Its success was like a blessing and a curse, because it it sort of made me realize I really, really wanted to do that and not so much the other stuff. And so the original idea about 6 months ago was that I pitched it to Eurogamer to try and do it full time at that site, because it's an amazing website. And I worked with so many brilliant games journalists there, and that really helped shape Here's a Thing in the first place. So originally I was going to try and do it there full time, and either, yeah, well, I guess the big problem with this, and the reason I did end up on Patreon, is that Here's a Thing, in the format that I had, usually the episodes would take like at least a couple of weeks of work.
Yeah.
And as I said, I was employed on a video team for daily videos, and those two things don't really mix so well, because YouTube's like ad revenue model supports daily videos. Like most of the big channels are, like PewDiePie, for example, biggest YouTuber in the world. You know, his whole thing is that he uploads one video every day and it's always over 10 minutes. And YouTube itself has sort of created an ecosystem that means that is by far the most profitable way to operate on that site if you're just relying on YouTube ads. So yes, I originally pitched it to Eurogamer to do it there, but trying to figure out a way to actually fund that was the tricky part.
Yeah, it's funny. It's really good right now that there is still the daily news grind you need for a site. And usually it's hard to support, hey, we're going to do this in-depth piece of journalism or just a video that looks at certain aspects of developments or teams, and it's going to take 2 weeks. And it's hard to pitch that to someone where it's like, what if we just did 14 smaller things in those 2 weeks and the money starts rolling in, baby? But like, now that we have these avenues where people who do have good ideas but don't want, well, actually can't lean on ad revenue, they can go do that. Like, that's maybe my favorite part of Patreon right now, where what, you know, what you're doing, what Danny is doing, that stuff couldn't really exist at a major site with the way that ads work. And when it does come to Patreon, we just talked about how the initial idea had gone through a lot of different variations, but how much leeway do you have now that it's live, now that people have handed you their money and said, go make something cool, I believe in you, how much leeway do you have to change it once it gets rolling? Because people are buying into the initial idea, and I know you're still early on this, so you don't have a great answer, but just in your head, if you get a whole bunch of feedback of, hey, you should try to do this, and then another half of your audience says, no, I think you should go more into this direction. At this point, is it more important that you stick with your initial concept, or do you have to roll with the punches?
I think, at least for the time being, as it has just launched, I want to stick as closely as I can with what the initial pitch says we're going to do. I think that's really important, because people have bought into this idea specifically. There is room, I think, on top of that, to do some extra bits here and there, smaller side projects, perhaps, or maybe try and, as I actually mentioned in the original pitch, if we find a really big story, it would be amazing to go even bigger on that and spend even more time on something if the story warrants that kind of work. So I think there's a little bit of wiggle room, but it's a relationship I've never really had with an audience before. I've asked for their support, and you know, it's arrived, and that's amazing, but it now means that I need to make sure I'm earning that support. I think, at least for the time being, at least for the first 12 months at least, I want to try and just nail this concept as much as possible before I really start changing too much. But you know what? I haven't, like, it literally launched 4 days ago. The first video is going up in, you know, the next couple of weeks. And who knows what I'll say on the other side of that. That's the plan for the time being.
Having a relationship with an audience like that is weird, because of course you want to placate them to a certain extent. You want to make sure that they're happy and they like what you're doing. But similar to game development, very often the people who are the most vocal are the people who might have good ideas but don't understand that, like, they can't be implemented that way. Or I think I was talking to Eric Pope, who does a lot of the community stuff for For Honor. And he had said, like, yes, we see all of that feedback, but a lot of those things you say, like, we can't do it for a whole bunch of development reasons that, if you're not in development, you don't fully understand. So I think some of the stuff might happen like that with you, where it's just, this would be a cool idea, but I can't do it because of X reason or Y budget or my location or something like that. But again, I think it's one of those kind of see how it goes and stick as close as you can to that original concept. And you did talk before about maybe not the limitations of Eurogamer, because Eurogamer is a fantastic site, great people there, but it has to kind of go down a very specific path if it wants to make money and do the things that it does. And we live in this weird world right now where a lot of people who are big on Patreon or are doing their own things, they start at this major site in order to gain some sort of recognition, to get experience, and they get an audience that way. But once you do gain a certain level of prominence, there's really only so far you can go at a GameSpot or an IGN or a Eurogamer. There is a certain ceiling there. Greg Miller had a certain ceiling at IGN. Danny O'Dwyer had a certain ceiling at GameSpot. Do you think we'll see more and more people moving to crowdfunding or something similar to create unique video series or content after they've been at big sites? Because you kind of need that launching pad for, I hate like the hashtag brand thing, but to build some sort of recognition before you get there. Do you think this is maybe a future roadmap we'll see of get to a big site, hopefully get your own audience that's not, doesn't just like you because you work at GameSpot, and then start your own thing?
I'm sure we'll see more of that. I think one of the other things we will hopefully see is some amount of that within some of these sites as well. It's something I talked about with Eurogamer about the idea when, like, I've been pretty open with them about the fact that I sort of came to the conclusion that Patreon was the only way to really fund this stuff. And for a while we were talking about whether or not to do it at Eurogamer and within that framework. And we were looking at, you know, they already do a little bit of that actually already. If you, I'm not sure if you're aware of Digital Foundry, Ultimate Tech Wizards. They are partly funded through Patreon despite being a part of the Gamer Network and Eurogamer family. And we were thinking about whether or not that would work for Here's a Thing. And you look across to, you know, publications like The Guardian, who are now, I think their supporter program is actually a bigger portion of their revenue over the last 12 months than their advertisement. Man. And that's a major publication still being able to go down that kind of route. I would like to think that at some point, sites like Eurogamer in particular will be able to attract that kind of support and then maybe pay for the more work intensive, whether it's video or written journalism within that framework as well.
Yeah, and Giant Bomb does that too. They have premium content where they can kind of... Yeah, like they of course still have like the daily quick look uploads, and you still need that to bring people around. But they can also kind of just take their time on stuff, in a healthy way. They're not like, oh, let's slack off for a week, but they can take their time with stuff because they're like, okay, these people like what we do. They understand that some of these things just take time, and we're not gonna push for 20 videos a day. We're just gonna do a few and make them good. So I do think within some of these structures there is room for, hey, what if we fund this in a different way, and then we'll be able to do what we want to do instead of be beholden to this content churn that is kind of impossible to break out of once you start. I've been there. Like those news churns, I was writing for, it was Game Ranks before Game Ranks became essentially a giant YouTube channel. So it was the site. And I remember writing like 6 news stories every single day. Just like waking up, churning out news. And I did that for like a year and a half, and it's impossible to not burn out. Like if the next time you write, there's new Train Simulator DLC coming out March 14th. Here's how much it is. Have a great day. Like you can't do that forever before entirely burning out. But once you start, you kind of have to keep doing it to support that site. It's a weird cycle. I just had to do a lot of budgeting for a big move, and even knowing what salary number I was dealing with made it difficult to decide what I could afford, how I can do anything. I don't want to of course sit here and talk about the exact number you're making or anything like that, but before flipping that crowdfunding switch, like what sort of calculations were you doing? Like did you have a specific number where you're like, if it hits this, I'm golden, if it goes below this, I need to start waiting tables after I'm done doing videos? Like how do you even determine your lifestyle or anything moving forward just without knowing what that number was going to be?
Yeah, that's absolutely a huge concern I have, because I live in Brighton as well, as I said before, and it's a really expensive part of the UK and just the world to live in, I think. So that was definitely on my mind. There were a few different plans, basically, depending on how well it did. It's exceeded my expectations by some way, thankfully, but... Eurogamer have just been incredible throughout this. I don't say that enough because, obviously, as I said, it was a discussion that I was having with that team, in particular with my editor, Ollie Welsh, about whether or not Here's a Thing could work there. And then once we realized it couldn't, they have just they mentioned that if the patron did like sort of well enough to live on, but needed just to be supplemented a little bit more, there would be guaranteed freelance there if I needed it, and that they themselves would help promote it. So a lot of my fears and concerns were they helped with, basically, and I can't thank them enough for that. I don't think many publications that you leave to go and start something independent would be so supportive. Yeah, I guess essentially it came down to, could it make a livable salary? If so, I can go for it full time. And that was my first stretch goal, essentially. If it meets this, then I'm just concentrating on People Make Games. I don't really need to think about too much outside of that. If it hadn't reached that, I would have, done freelance at Eurogamer, maybe a couple of other places, and just tried to build it up over time and eventually get to that point.
Good on Eurogamer for supporting that. You're right, that's rare.
Like, they've been amazing, just amazing.
That's incredible. Like, I couldn't imagine a prominent person leaving a site and them, like, I don't think I've ever seen that, where the site's like, you know, good luck and I'm going to retweet this and help you in any sort of way. That's, again, that seems super rare to me.
It was like on the day that I left, which was the same day that I launched, and the top post on Eurogamer that day was from Ollie, my editor, about the new Patreon and,
oh my god,
the fact that it was starting. And so they picked a terrible picture of me, though. So I had this really ridiculous just face, like, hovering over Eurogamer the whole day. So I'm not sure
I think that's
actually
the give and take, though, right? They put you on the front page, but they picked the worst picture, and they might alter a little bit. So, like, one eye is a little lower, your nose is now pointed up. Like, I think that you have to do that to be like, here you go, motherfucker. Here's all the advertising you need.
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't really talked about it. Just to give people an idea of what you do, like, how did the concept for Here's the Thing and eventually People Make Games start? And what are you doing right now on Patreon? Because we've said it, we've talked about it, and the funding and everything that goes into it. But what are you doing?
So essentially, it is a series of videos that tells cool stories about video games and people that make them, which is a very broad idea. But if you look through, Here's the Thing is where it was born back at Eurogamer, and most of those stories were based on the idea of trying to find a cool angle into a bigger story. So, for example, I was fascinated by the voice acting strike that was happening within the games industry throughout a big portion of last year. And the hook that we found for that in Here's a Thing was that there was a voice actor in Fallout 4 that had done all this voice acting work, played a really significant character in the game, and yet didn't know he was in Fallout 4 until basically just before the game came out. And that sentence there is the interesting one. And the way I like to think about it is that it's like the kind of thing you could say that to someone in a pub and they would want to hear about it and wouldn't just let their eyes glaze over and slowly drink their pint instead. That's the initial, an anecdotal hook that then can tie into the fact that voice actors are going through all this weird stuff with video game companies where they sometimes aren't told what games they're working on, which affects how much pay they can ask for. There's a whole dispute over what kind of royalties they receive in return, and also a bunch of stuff in terms of health and safety about the vocal strain with longer voice acting sessions. Most voice actors have to do some kind of mocap at this stage, and exactly how safe those setups can be sometimes is a little worrying. And there's a lot to take in there. As like already, I'm losing you as I've gone through those things, and so we start off with that awesome anecdote and then use that as the framing for a much bigger story. And that's sort of the idea with every episode of Here's a Thing and now People Make Games. So it's hopefully the opposite of clickbait, because the whole episode will be framed around that cool idea, but we slowly use that to introduce a slightly bigger topic usually.
And that was a great example with that cool idea where you start with the voice actors and you end up finding this incredible anecdote that you can kind of base the video around. But how do you keep finding these cool anecdotes once you start going into these concepts? Like, how do you end up at, I wonder if the Yakuza were involved with Nintendo early on, or I bet we're catching Pokemon wrong? Because there's so many, there are definitely times where you can be like, oh, I'm interested in this very, I don't know, like Speed Tree. I think I should do a video about Speed Tree. And then you realize like, oh my God, there's this entire aspect of Speed Tree that involves the black market and people are dying for the sake of Speed Tree. But like, mm-hmm. The fact is you have the root of Speed Tree. Like, how does this keep happening where you start with these ideas and these incredible anecdotes that you can base an entire video keep appearing?
Yeah, it's an odd one. I think basically since I think it's the one part of the job that I'm pretty good at. Like a lot of the video production side and the journalistic side, there are much better people out there. But I think one of the things I've always managed to have is just this part of my brain that never really switches off when I'm reading articles or watching GDC talks. I'm always looking for that little the angle that's actually interesting in the middle of it all. There isn't really a guaranteed sort of method. Most of these, looking, there was 22 episodes of Here's the Thing, and most of them came from completely different sources. But for example, the What Happens to Your Steam Account When You Die, which is one of my favorite titles for a video. I think that is a really interesting topic, but that is the angle right there. It's like, it's something, if you haven't thought about that and you read that, you want to know the answer. And that video came about from watching, I remember there was a video interview that PC Gamer did with a lawyer that specialized in the video games industry. And it was a quickfire interview where they rattled through a bunch of questions, and I can't remember any of them except for the one where one of the answers, I don't think the question was even trying to hit on this exactly, but the answer to that question was, and Valve haven't even sorted out their terms of use yet to let you leave your Steam account to someone in your will. And I remember hearing that, and then just that was the next 2 weeks of my life. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And basically all of these stories have some element of that. It's often just found buried in an interview or a post on Resetra or a GDC talk or a podcast that I'm listening to. The Fallout 4 story I talked about with the voice actor, I remember listening to a podcast with Phil Lamar, who isn't the voice actor that this video focuses around, but it's he's a really close friend of Keith Farley, the voice actor who didn't know he was in Fallout 4, and mentioned it offhand in that interview. And again, it was sort of a light bulb moment, and then I spent 2 weeks chasing after that story from the moment I finished listening. That's a really terrible answer. Sorry, because I hope...
No, it's the right answer. Well, also, you don't want to be like the magician who's like, here's exactly how I do it. I think part of this is like, it happens organically. Like,
yeah, there have been a couple of times where it hasn't. Every time I've tried not to do it organically, it's been rubbish. My worst episodes have been the ones where I've tried to force a story when it wasn't quite there. I did an episode on the Overwatch balance triangle, and it's because I got to interview Jeff Kaplan, and I thought, Jeff Kaplan is so interesting, Overwatch is massive, there's got to be an episode in this, and it's forced, and I can't quite look at, I haven't watched that episode in ages because I'm a little bit frustrated with it. So yeah.
Good on you on actually admitting that. I think a lot of people just say like, everything I do is incredible and I'm not going to judge it. Like, there's definitely times where you record something or do something, we're like, yep, that I was having a bad week. Like, I had certain expectations going in, and then I had already put 20 hours of work into it where I was like, well, I'm not going to scrap it. I'll put it together somehow. So like, yeah, that totally happens. Are there developers reaching out to you at this point with crazy stories, asking you to do videos on them? Just like, I would assume there's so many things we don't know about that happen in game development that are absolutely insane. And I've now spent, as of this recording, like 2 weeks as a game developer, and I already feel like my eyes have been opened in a way that I couldn't have really anticipated, just like the things that I'm learning and the things that maybe I misunderstood beforehand. Like, are you getting like Greg Kasavin suddenly emails you and says like, I don't know if you know this, Bastion used to be a first person shooter, do you want to do a video? Like, is that happening?
It happens a little bit, but so far the angles haven't been quite right. I think at least from my point of view, the reason Here's a Thing worked was because of that anecdotal hook that leads in. And I do get game developers occasionally reaching out, or PRs as well, reaching out and suggesting ideas that none of them have quite worked for me. And so far I've basically got a list that I'm slowly going through, but not making a lot of progress actually, because I think there's something like 60 ideas in this Trello board that I have. And every time I finish one, something else seems to just get in the way and pop up instead of making any progress on the next one on the list. That does happen sometimes, but it's not always presented as a pitch for Here's a Thing. It's usually just meeting a developer. When I was at Eurogamer, often this would often happen where we'd have our interview for the the game that was being released or the update that was happening or whatever it was. And then after the interview, we'd just sort of, I'd be packing away my camera equipment and then we'd get onto talking about something that the light bulb moment would happen again. So more by accident than with intention, I think.
If you did do something based off like a developer, a publisher, a PR reaching out to you, would it kind of feel weird like you, the way that you framed the content would somewhat be beholden to this person's view on it? Because there's that stupid but true saying of like, oh, there's this person's side of the story, there's that person's side of the story, and there's the truth. Like, there's always the three. And if you actually talk to someone who it's just, sure, it's still a firsthand account, but you're only really getting one side of how the story happened, is there any sort of concern in your head about that?
Yeah, there would be. It depends on the story. I think, if it's like an interesting sort of game mechanic angle, then perhaps that can still work. If it's something about like the, you know, a cancelled game or something that has a little bit more of an internal struggle involved, yeah, that would definitely require multiple interviews separate from whoever had reached out in the first place.
Yeah, you couldn't be like, here's why Hideo Kojima left, it's just sourced from Konami. And you're like, okay, maybe there's something a little bit more to this story that I'm not seeing right now.
Yeah, turns out Kojima was just a real jerk the whole time. Who knew?
He was a part of the mafia, the same mafia involved with Nintendo, and they had to just cut ties at that point. It's the only actual solution that he's really not. I'm just kidding, everyone. So you mentioned you have this giant, deep list of ideas that you're kind of cycling through and certain things get pushed up to the top. But when it comes to actually deciding what's going to be interesting for people and also what gets actual views on YouTube, you don't have to worry about that as much anymore, because again, you're being supported. So even if you get 20,000, that's fine, but you want to get more. How do you determine what games or stories to cover? Is it important to go for the latest games and try to maximize SEO and everything like that? Or is it much more about the insanity of the story and the layers of the story itself? Because I think Twitch is an example of this, where very often you need to be playing the newest games to keep up. Then there's also the aspect of everyone else is playing those games. What if I pull out Dark Cloud 2 on PlayStation 2 and start playing that? Even though it's not hot right now, there's this certain affection for it. So are you trying to always do new games? Are you trying to do games that have a cult following? What's the process?
I guess I'm less concerned now that the Patreon has launched and it seems to be doing pretty well, that I'm less concerned about chasing the big views from a business point of view. I think I will struggle, if I'm completely honest, not to let go of that part of me that likes to see a video do six figures, which is something that has come from working on, like, I spent 3 years at Eurogamer and 2 years at Video Gamer before. And whilst working at both those sites, you know, it was about creating videos that did enough views to pay for the channel. But I think that has left something in my brain that's going to, I'm going to struggle to switch off, which is chasing a story that does really well. So I would love to do, you know, do that. It's a story that I'm sure everyone's after right now, but find out about some of the inner workings when Fortnite shifted from Save the World to Battle Royale, just because I know that would be a massive story and it would be exciting to be in the middle of it all. However, it's also a huge relief to me not to have that as my only priority. When I was working on Here's a Thing at Eurogamer, they were two of my most recent ones, actually. Actually, I'll focus on one in particular. I did a story about a gaming brain supplement called God Mode. And it's probably the story I'm proudest of in my entire time in games journalism, but it's only done 30,000 views on YouTube, which does not make it worthwhile in a traditional sense. But I really enjoyed that story, and the reaction to it from the people that watched was perhaps the strongest I've seen as well. And I think that is fine if we're going down the Patreon route. So in terms of chasing a story for it to do really well, I think that's probably just an ego thing that I need to let go of going forwards, but we'll probably struggle a little bit, if I'm honest.
I think it's going to be impossible not to struggle. Like, when you make that transition, again, I wrote news for the longest time. I was writing reviews and features and stuff like that. You're always going to have that mindset of, is this something that will grab attention? Is this SEO worthy? And maybe that'll fade, but that's just how I think your brain is going to function for a while. But as long as you know that you can every once in a while do one of those videos that you said, like, maybe it just got 30,000, but the response was there. And the fact that it didn't have Overwatch or Fortnite or something in the title, maybe it's not going to grab those people, but that work is still super valuable. What, I mean, I'm not trying to spoil that video right there, but what did the supplement work?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I should have painted. No, basically I took the supplement for a couple of weeks and spoke to a nootropics expert, a scientist that had done her PhD in nootropics, who basically pointed out that, I mean, you'll get some boost from it because there's quite a lot of caffeine in there, and that was the gist of it. But it's a whole thing that I can see now, looking at this video, which was 20 minutes long and about a brain supplement, why people didn't think it would be interesting, but it is. The person that started this company is Scott Miller, who founded 3D Realms and Duke Nukem, and he's gone from video games into video game brain supplements. It's supposed to be his other huge passion in life. But the way it was advertised, if anyone listening is close to a web browser right now, just Google God Mode and go on, try and find the site that it was actually being sold on. It was ridiculous. It was all this like a very dark background with all these huge ridiculous claims in big bold red text, like it'll make you think like Steven Spielberg and Elon Musk. It'll reduce your depression and anxiety. It will make you think faster and smarter. It will... they had Judit Polgar, who's one of the best chess players in the world, repping it, saying that she took it to make her better at chess. I reached out to her to try and interview her about that statement, and mysteriously her picture, her huge quote on the website was suddenly pulled.
Oh my God.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff there. It was really dodgy. I ended up having a phone call with Scott Miller at the end of this video piece that I did, where I presented a bunch of claims to him, like the fact that it doesn't, there is no scientific evidence that it reduces depression and anxiety, and he panicked a little bit. It's a very awkward phone call with lots of long silences on his end, and a bunch of that stuff ended up getting pulled from the site. It was a whole weird story. I'm not sure how I ended up doing it, but I loved it. And it's exciting to me that I can spend, you know, a month working on a story about a really dodgy pill being sold on the internet for gamers and prove that it's bullshit.
That is some real ass journalism. Like, that is some real actually going through, doing the thing yourself, calling people. And this is like a way, like, this is a way too deep and probably unfair question to ask you, but I'll do it anyway. Do you think there's enough real, you know, quote unquote, real games journalism out there? Because we do really get some in the weeds reporting from Kotaku, and you'll see stuff from Polygon where it's this really embedded take on, like, here's why Destiny didn't work, or here's what happened to Prey 2 before it became that other Prey reboot. But most news is, here's a new trailer, here's a release date, here's this other video talking about this gameplay aspect. And we just talked earlier about how it's understandable why that happens, where you've got to have that certain content churn to feed the advertising beast and make things work. But are we missing actual reporting that goes beyond the hype and release cycle for a specific game?
I think your game should be on that list as well, actually. They have an amazing reporting team who do manage to focus on investigation outside of their sort of daily news pieces as well. That's the only reason I ended up doing Here's a Thing, is because I looked at those guys and was like, I want to do your job, but on video. And I think there are some really incredible game journalists out there. I think if it's lacking, it perhaps is lacking a little bit on YouTube at the moment, which is why I felt it was the time to try and do this as my full-time job. Obviously you've got people like Daniel Dwyer, who are nailing it with Noclip, and Super Bunny Hop, who I think you know as well. Yeah. There is good video game journalism on YouTube, but not very much at the moment. So I think particularly in video, it is lacking at the moment, and it would be amazing to see more stuff happen there. It's just difficult to fund it, basically, because you can't start a YouTube channel from scratch as a job and just do that, because it just won't pay for itself. You need either sponsorship or crowdfunding to back that up. And yeah, I think I can definitely see why it hasn't taken off in any major way just yet within the video games sphere, at least.
Yeah, and there's just so much. It's a bummer that the funding and the current model for websites doesn't fully support that style of, hey, I'm going to spend a month on this just for one story, because there's so much out there. Again, just going to my experiences of being somewhere for 2 weeks where I'm talking to, you know, we have developers who've worked on XCOM 2, who've worked on, you know, the original Modern Warfare, and you know, like one of my bosses is like the original Tomb Raider developer. So like there's, and they'll just say things, and in my brain, which is still on journalist mode, every once in a while I'll be like, that's a story. Like, that's a story right there. And it's like, there's 8 things like that happen a day where it's like, man, I wish this stuff could. And a lot of the stuff, there's like NDAs or things that you don't want to speak poorly about past bosses or anything like that. But there's just so much out there that I would love to be able to like see in some sort of video or even long form way, that it's just the way life is right now. It's really difficult to do that. Looking at your own videos, how important is knowing how to properly edit together game clips and yourself on screen when it comes to getting views on your videos? Because I think so many people just assume, oh, if it's a good idea, it'll do well, it'll have big hits. But similar with podcasting, if you don't have great audio quality, if you don't learn how to host and carry a conversation, it doesn't really matter how good the topic is or how good the guest is. It's going to struggle. You kind of see that similar on YouTube, where if you didn't have the editing chops, it wouldn't really matter how good the concept is.
Yeah, absolutely. I, weirdly enough, did a lecture / seminar at a university that has a games journalism course in Staffordshire in England. And I saw a bunch of students do their own take on Here's a Thing. And I think the story angles that they came up with were fairly strong, but actually trying to turn that into something that you can break down in a 10-minute video and then edits it in a way that gives it a nice flow, they found that perhaps the most challenging part, even more so than finding the story in the first place. So yeah, that is an extremely important side of the job, and actually one that I haven't really been able to do justice just yet, I don't think, because I mentioned earlier on that like a lot of these videos that I did with Here's a Thing, I was finishing the edit on the same day that it was going live after having pulled an all-nighter beforehand. And yeah, there's only so much you can do when you don't have the time to really nail the production. And another thing that I found in particular with these stories, quite a few of the stories that I work on either reference a... Sometimes they're less to do with the game and more to do with the developers themselves, or they might be to do with a really old game or a really ugly game. Sorry, Dwarf Fortress. It's the most incredible thing in the world, but it's difficult to watch a video featuring gameplay from Dwarf Fortress if you don't already care about the game. So that actually makes it... There is a challenge there, and part of People Make Games is the... And something that I'm really excited about doing more and more of in the future is that I'm actually working with an illustrator and animator to deal with that problem, basically. When there aren't enough assets, when the story's too old for there to be relevant gameplay, or if the gameplay is not good enough, or if it's not really about gameplay, it's about people, it's amazing to have someone come in with a different style of craft and help flesh that out. So that is what... At the moment, People Make Games is going to be a continuation of what I was doing with Here's a Thing, but I get to spend more time on it. But the dream for this whole premise is that at some point it's going to be me and an illustrator working side by side on this stuff and doing... that's not something we've seen a lot of, I don't think, so far in this particular part of YouTube, and I can't wait to try and see if that works and see what people make of like cool stories but with just beautiful animation to go along with them.
I love this idea, and I think that's totally attainable if your Patreon keeps going in the direction it's going. How long did it take before you stopped hating your seeing yourself on camera? Like, is there a point now where you can actually just like watch yourself on video and be like, oh, I'm pretty good at this? Or are you still in the mode of, oh my God, I can't believe I did this with my face or this with my voice or this with my hands?
I am definitely past that now. I think I wouldn't ask the same question to you actually, because found a similar thing with audio basically. How long did it take you to get used to hearing your voice when you're editing the podcast?
I would say I had done a few other podcasts before, and I had heard my voice just enough that I would say within the first like 10 episodes, I got to a point where I realized certain vocal peccadilloes or things I said that annoyed the hell out of me and tried to adjust them. But there's also, and you'll probably say the same thing, there's certain things that you really can't stop yourself from doing. You have natural tendencies that just happen that can be annoying, but it's how it is. But I would say within 10 episodes, I was like, all right, I'm able to listen to this entire thing and not cringe. I'm okay with the way I'm coming off, even if every once in a while I will take out chunks of like a really part of like a dumb question I ask where I'm like, oh, I'm going to make myself sound a little bit better. But most of the time it's just straight audio.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I'm at. I think it took about, I'd say between, maybe a bit longer than yourself actually, between about 6 months and 12 months to really get used to the whole thing. And now it doesn't faze me at all. Although, yeah, it almost becomes a more mechanical thing. I've spent so long editing video of myself that it's just, I was just like, oh, okay, yeah, that thing that I do that I don't like, chop. And there's no emotion involved to that anymore. Whereas to begin with, I'd be like, oh my God, this is horrible. I'm so awkward and weird and my accent doesn't make sense. And it doesn't, but I'm now just completely okay with that. And yeah, it's just part of the process.
I feel like I need to do an entire podcast talking to people like you and Simon Miller and Steve Burns to understand like British accents in general. I have no experience. Like every time someone's like, I'm from this part of the UK, I'm like, I don't know where that is. And that's my fault for not being as cultured as I should be. But you could pull off any accent right now and I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. Like that's the correct accent for whatever region you're in. Cause I just have no idea.
Yeah. Mine is just, it's a kind of a peculiar one. It isn't an accent anymore. I grew up in Stoke-on-Trent, which is in, sort of the middle or more northern, I guess, part of England, and now I live on the most south part. Like I'm right on the southern coast, just below London. I live in Brighton, and so those two cities are very, very different. And it's just a mess now. I don't really know what I am. When I go back home to Stoke, people think I'm trying to sound posh. And when I like talk to anyone in the south of England and say book and cook rather than buck and cook, that's just hilarious. So I don't really know. I think I'm trapped.
Do you ever feel like you're missing out on specific opportunities because you don't live in the US where a lot of major game developers are? I like time zones are hard to put together and you have a lot of developers around you, but is there ever part of you that's like, man, if I lived in San Francisco or LA, I would be able to get more access to a lot of stories? Or have you never felt that way?
Oh, I absolutely feel that, definitely. Yeah, I don't think the UK just isn't as strong as it was right now. And I'm sure Brexit will help with that. Thanks, guys. So yeah, a lot of the stories that I've done in Here's the Thing are with American game developers. And I would love, I'm so jealous of people that live in San Francisco and GDC just turns up once a year.
Oh my God.
I went to visit, I was there this year and I went to visit the GameSpot US office, which is literally around the corner. And I was so cross with them because there were a bunch of people working late on all sorts of things when I got there. And some of them just, it wasn't really worth their time to go to GDC because of the types of stuff that they usually work on. It just wasn't really worth it. But it's about a 10-15 minute walk and I traveled 11 hours in a plane and had to like recover for 2 days before going to the show. And what I would give for GDC to happen in Brighton. We do actually have a show. It's called Develop, and it takes place in a hotel, quite a sad looking hotel on the seafront. And
you're really selling this.
It's not so great. We had Kojima once. That was exciting, but
That's something.
Yeah. But that was quite a highlight. So it's not quite the same.
I've lived East Coast my entire life. I was like around Pittsburgh area, then moved to Jacksonville, Florida. And I, 3 weeks ago, I just moved to LA. And it's weird that by the time this goes live, but like in a few weeks, E3 is happening. And I've only gone to one E3. And of course, I had to fly all the way across the country. So it's like a 6 hour flight or something like that. And now I live a few miles from where E3 is going to be. So like that part's really weird and I haven't fully adjusted yet. I think I'd rather have GDC right next to me of just it's not casual, but when you think of E3, you think of just how insane and fast moving everything is. And no one really has time to stop and talk. And GDC, a lot of that is, seminars, it's discussions, it's people stopping and talking and networking. And that's actually way more interesting to me, but I'm still trying to adjust to how fortunate I am to be in a spot where it's like, hey, I'm just going to go walk to E3, or I'm going to take an Uber over to E3 today to see you guys later. Like, it's a really strange thing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really cool. Yeah, I definitely agree with the GDC part. I'd say about half of that show seems to happen outside of the show itself. You just need to be in the same place where everyone turns up. So yeah, that's cool. Are you going to go to E3 this year then? Or?
Yes, I am. I'm already trying to set up like which parties. I'm going to Michael Pachter's party. We're doing a small get together at like a close by bar. I'm an associate producer, so like a lot of that job description is just do a lot of random different things, like fill the gaps in a lot of ways. So suddenly I'm like, all right, I'm going to make calls to set up E3 parties for all of us, and I'm going to try to make sure we get to these certain meetings. But yeah, are you going this year?
No, this is the first one I haven't gone to in a little while. I don't think E3 really makes as much sense for me anymore. I want to try and work into the budget GDC, because I think that show is the best one. But
You'd probably walk away with 18 video ideas from GDC if you go.
I did go this year, so yeah, that was handy just beforehand. E3, I think I always found with that show, from what I was doing with the job, I actually managed to... You could keep up the show a lot easier from home or from the hotel room. And then it was just about getting the right interview here and there around that. So, yeah, it doesn't make quite as much sense. But I'm very excited to watch it as just someone... I can just watch it and not worry about immediately making a video about the latest game that's just been announced. And I'm so excited about that.
Oh, you're going to love it. I remember that first moment where I stopped writing about games and watched E3, where I was like, oh my God, I can just enjoy this. Like, I can react to a trailer without thinking like, gotta get that news post up, or gotta start creating this certain like audio bite for this. It is a religious experience when you're able to enjoy E3 without those thoughts.
I'm thinking of putting it on the television in the living room and actually sitting on the sofa to watch it, which is just blowing my mind right now. I might get some snacks.
You should get like Cheetos. the UK has Cheetos, right? Am I?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Do you have Doritos? Are there any things that like we totally have that you don't?
We do. We actually have our own version of Cheetos called Wotsits, which I think is fun.
That sounds fake. Is that real?
Yeah. God, it just sounds so British. Wotsits.
That is unbelievable. I thought you made... Oh, my God. You could be doing one of those YouTube videos where it's like, here's three different British snacks. Which one's real? Which two are real? Which one is fake? And I would have guessed fake on that one.
Yeah. It's a weird country. It's quite strange.
Again, unbelievably jealous. It sounds so much cooler than where I live. Are you ever running into situations where you learn about incredible stories in development, but you're NDA'd or somehow barred from actually making a video about it? Like, are there limits on what you can talk about without accidentally getting someone who gave you that information in trouble?
Yeah, occasionally. I haven't had it with... I haven't yet had to sign an NDA for a story that I'm working on for Here's a Thing, but I did have... I did a piece on the cancelled Prey 2, the video itself was about what the game would have looked like through the eyes of the people that have been working on it. But I also had a story to go along that about why it fell apart and the relationship between Human Head Studios and Bethesda and why it got so confusing and why the game actually got squashed in the end, which was... I thought equally as interesting, but it's something I end up having to hold back because it, would have got some of the people involved with that into potential legal trouble, which was a shame because I have the story pretty much ready to go, but I just couldn't find a way to do it that made sense. Mostly because in the original video that went alongside that, the people that I'd spoken to were very involved with that, so there was no real way to... sort of promise anonymity, and that was really tricky. So never had to actually sign something, and then that's not allowed me to continue the story. But there's been a couple of examples of just having to go, okay, no, need to step away from this one now. That's really annoying.
Yeah, and a lot of this stuff, I'd assume it's probably easier to get these stories based on games that are 10 years old, where people really aren't as worried about concealing is the wrong word, but when it's fresh, like Prey, or even like a few years back, if you're like, I'm going to do a Duke Nukem Forever video or whatever like that, when that's still so recent, maybe the developers or the publisher definitely doesn't want to get that story out there. But if you're like, here's why Banjo 3E didn't happen, I don't really think anyone at Rare is going to be like, motherfucker, you can't get that precious information out there. Like, the timing of a lot of this is really important.
Yeah. Also, I think the fact that Prey 2 is wrapped up with Bethesda and ZeniMax, yeah. and everyone's a little bit terrified of ZeniMax's legal response to anything, which doesn't help. But yeah, I actually find with these kind of stories, I much prefer working on older games when I can, because you can sidestep a lot of the stuff you've just mentioned, really. And yeah, speak to people that are really closely involved with those games, but without having to deal with the company side of that or PR side of that, which tends to slow things down massively.
Yeah, ZeniMax will sue a motherfucker. That'll just happen. That should actually be like the tagline on their website.
I should probably be thankful that I hadn't published that, because maybe I just wouldn't exist anymore.
Just disappear, like, yeah. just I don't know what happened to him. We actually don't even remember him anymore. They somehow like wiped his memory from ours. What has been the most surprising video that you've worked on in terms of learning something entirely new? I would assume maybe that supplement one is up there, but have you had a wow, I had no idea kind of moment that really took you by surprise?
Yeah, I think the supplement one was a big, it was the most surprising to me because it was such a different type of story, and at least my eyes featured a genuine crook involved in it, rather than just like, it's, I'd been used to being just annoyed at like the publisher's response to something in a story, and it's a bit more difficult to really picture that than an actual individual. But I think the the list, which is the most surprising to me, I think actually, so I'm a huge XCOM fan. It's my favorite series, and I did a piece on the original XCOM, which had actually been cancelled whilst they were developing it, but no one told the developers, and they just let them carry on working on it in secret, and the game, basically until the game was ready, and then managed to blag their way through to keeping the whole project alive. And it was it was to do with Microprose as a company had told them to squash the project, but the UK side of Microprose really believed in it and quietly kept it going and kept it funded, because there were only like 3 or 4 developers involved, and basically ignored the instructions they'd been given and let Julian go up and his brother and a couple of programmers carry on working on it and saw it through to fruition, which is amazing to me, because that is my favorite. That is literally the story about how my favorite series just never came to be. Like one particular meeting happened that saved that whole thing. And without that, Firaxis would never have made XCOM or XCOM 2. You wouldn't be working with someone that had helped make XCOM 2. Like that whole thing comes down to one meeting within the UK office of Microprose where they saved it.
That kind of shit is awesome. Like that's unbelievably fascinating. And when it can intersect with your favorite series or something you really enjoy, it's a whole nother level to it. Like, I'm a huge, this is a weird series to really cling to, but Beautiful Joe fan. And I'm just like, there's part of me that's like, what really happened to that series? Because you get a lot of the talk about like, oh, here's why it ended or why there wasn't a 3. But part of me is also like, where are all the side stories there? Like, yeah. How didn't that happen? And like, for me, maybe I'd be really bad at your job, because I'd be like, I really liked Ark the Lad, Twilight of the Spirits on PS2 that 7 people played. Why did this one character say this at one point? And my video would have 8 views, and it's just like 8 people who played that game. So maybe I'm not the right person for this. For you, I mean, what sort of content schedule, to wrap things up here, what sort of content schedule can people expect from you? How can they support you in what you're doing? And where can they find you on social media?
Yeah, so we're looking at the moment, a standard People Make Games schedule will be a new episode going live every 2 weeks, unless we find something just massive and surprising that we want to really focus on. But yeah, the typical schedule should be every 2 weeks, and our very first episode should be going live at the very start of next month, which is, really not too far away, so that'll be good. And yes, if you'd like to find me on Twitter, it's just Bratters, Brattez. I've got a weird surname, sorry. But more importantly, if you'd like to check out the work we're going to be doing, head over to YouTube and search for People Make Games, which is where all that stuff is going to live.
That's awesome. Hey, thanks so much for doing this. It was funny when I reached out to you, I had no idea you were doing a Patreon. I thought you were just like going to still be at Eurogamer, and we had talked. And you're like, can we wait like a week before we do this? Because I'm about to launch something and I have no idea how it's like, just had no idea. And it's cool to see, you know, obviously you were nervous, and to see how incredible it's done so far, I know you're going to nail this. You already have the experience and you've shown that you're really good at this. It's fun and heartening to see this sort of, whether you want to call it games journalism or some sort of digging into different aspects. It's cool to see that this has an audience. This has a major audience, and it was a bummer for the longest time being like, I don't know if this content can exist on major sites. And now people who are good at this having an avenue is incredible. So wish you all the best on this. Can't wait to watch all your videos. And yeah, if people want to support you, they should do that, because what you do is rad.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, you were one of the first people to actually find out that I was even a gamer. So you had a scoop there. That was good.
I know. If I was still in games media, I would have scooped that immediately and be like, guess what? Exclusive.
Well, thank you for having me on the podcast. Yeah, I'm in very good company. You have really cool guests on this show. So, yeah, appreciate you asking me.
Yeah, I've been super fortunate in that way where people keep saying yes. So I'm going to keep crossing my fingers that people keep saying yes. It's a snowball effect, too. Once they see like, oh, you've had this person, I'll do this. I'm like, yep, that totally works. So yeah. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Hopefully tune back in for the next episode of the 1099.